The following is an interview with Mr. Joseph Califano by telephone on April 5th, 1991.
Yes, hi, Mr. Califano.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes, how are you?
Good.
First of all, let me just make sure you understand that I'm tape recording.
That's fine.
That's okay, good. The first thing
How do you tape it? Is it just hooked to your phone?
Actually, I have a direct connection. It's like the jack hooks directly into the machine.
Great.
So it gives a clear mm-hmm. connection, clear recording. Let's see. I'd like to start off just to ask you if you have any sort of general reflections or observations about Bill Friday based on what you know and your past experiences with him, both with regard to his leadership style, to the extent that you could comment on that, and decision making, policy making style.
Well, that, in terms of, he chaired an education task force during the Johnson years.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I first came in contact with him, and he did a superb job. the issue, I think, and the burning issue at the time, as I recall, was whether federal aid education should be focused on poor children, or whether there should be general aid to education, which was the desire of the NEA and the Republicans. And he came down for aid to keep focusing the aid on poor children. And he did. I know he did a great job with that. I don't. You must have that. But I mean, it was 67 or something like that.
Yes.
And we came down to the University of North Carolina to look for ideas when I used to make a tour every spring to various campuses around the country to get ideas for Great Society programs for the next January. And the other contact I had with him was over the issue of desegregation.
Mm-hmm.
And there we disagreed.
Mm-hmm. On the latter, I guess you had extensive, fairly long contacts over...
Pardon me?
Your contacts with him on the latter, that is, on the case of desegregation, were over several years, 2 years or so.
Well, you have to put that... My contacts with North Carolina were over a few years. I had almost no direct contact with Bill Friday.
Mm-hmm.
I think I did send people down there.
Mm-hmm.
I think I sent David Tatel, who ran the Office for Civil Rights, and I sent Dick Beattie, who was then probably the general counsel
mm-hmm.
of HEW, down there. But I'm not sure I ever had a direct conversation with him.
Uh-huh.
On that subject, I just can't remember.
Uh-huh. Let me back up a little bit and ask you about the early development of the desegregation case with regard to North Carolina. In the spring of 1977, the case was thrust to your attention, I guess, because of the order of Judge Pratt, which required that your department do something and develop a set of criteria in the spring of 77.
Right.
And that chronology of that, I gather, is somewhere between April and July, the criteria were developed. I'm wondering, as best you can recollect, I know this has been 14 years, what do you remember as being the main considerations and objectives insofar as you had contact with the criteria? I know you...
and really, let me just preface everything I say that if the documents show something different, go by the documents.
Yeah.
Not by my memory.
Uh-huh.
The objective was to promote the desegregation of higher education.
Mm-hmm.
The techniques, as I recall, were to... have courses in white colleges that were not in black colleges and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
among other things. We expected, as a general matter, that North Carolina would have been, since Friday was regarded as a progressive, one of the most progressive Southern educators, mm-hmm. that North Carolina would have been one of the first states to agree.
Mm-hmm.
As it turned out, they were the last mm-hmm. to come to terms with desegregation. I guess what we did not account for was the number of black colleges in North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
which I guess created a serious problem for Bill Friday.
Mm-hmm. Made it a more complex problem, you think, from his point of view, or your point of view also?
I don't know whether. Look, I know one thing in my years at HEW. When we tried to desegregate or enforce civil rights laws for women, for the disabled, for Hispanics, we had virtually no resistance. When we tried to enforce the civil rights laws for blacks, we had resistance everywhere.
Hmm. That was true all along the
line. North Carolina was no exception.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
That was true north, south, east, and west.
Uh-huh.
But in this case, North Carolina was by far the most resistant of the southern states.
Uh-huh.
No, I think it was numbers. I think there were just larger numbers of blacks, larger numbers of black universities, and that's why the resistance was larger.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd have to ask them.
Uh-huh.
I can't judge their motives.
Uh-huh. In general, in the negotiations that involved the department, there was a lot. Obviously, you were a very busy person, and you delegated responsibility. At certain points, you must have been involved. Did you work through the political leadership to any great extent? For example, Governor Hunt, did you?
I'm sure I talked to Governor Hunt about it, but not
a lot.
Just to urge him to do it. I mean, I talked to other Southern governors. I have to remember there was another thing going on at the same time. I was in the middle of the the anti-smoking campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, North Carolina was the number one state fighting that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was being fought by Governor Hunt. Jesse Helms was trying to get riders on appropriations bills to take away our funds for
mm-hmm.
any anti-smoking effort. I mean, it was, there were cartoons. In fact, I've got one on my wall. I mean, they did cartoons of me down there.
Uh-huh.
Political cartoons. So it wasn't, I'm just trying to see this one. that problem, that complicated and made less effective my ability to deal with
mm-hmm.
with the political structure.
So there was
could call the governor of Virginia, I could call the governor of Alabama, the governor of Texas, the governor of South Carolina. I didn't have any problem. And I could call Jim Hunt, who's a friend of mine, but he was at war over the smoking campaign.
Uh-huh.
Hunt and Jesse Helms went to President Carter asking to fire me.
Uh-huh.
So it was not a, we weren't having, that element in terms of making the situation more complicated, the element of the ability to have a discourse with the political leadership was very difficult in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. So there was a definite connection between the desegregation case and the whole smoking campaign.
It made my ability to use the political structure to get the colleges desegregated, it really hindered my ability to use the political structure.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I hear a lot of, and I've talked to a lot of people from about this case from the university's point of view, and one of the things that you hear a lot of is that this perception on their part that the university was being singled out, and I'm wondering how you would respond to that.
Well, I think you can I think you can look at the other states. I mean, I don't think North Carolina was asked to do anything that the other states weren't asked to do. So in that sense, I don't think they were being singled out. I mean, they were singled out in the sense that they became the only university, the only state that wouldn't agree. And, you know, it was not easy on our part either, because you have to remember, we were sitting there with Judge Pratt. I mean, a federal judge sitting in Washington, D.C. with a clerk or two, desegregating the school higher education systems of, what, 11 states or 9 states?
Yes.
I forget how many. You know, a case that would never have occurred had the Nixon administration just gone along on some rational pace and desegregated and forced the law.
Did you find...
I tried to get relieved, you know, from all those court orders on the ground that we were ready to enforce the law, because I had another court order with another judge who was running the Office of Civil Rights.
So you were feeling considerable pressure.
Well, it was pressure from the court.
From the court, yeah.
Sure. Indeed, at one point, Joe Rao, who was, I don't know who he was representing. Who brought that suit?
LDF.
Yeah, I guess he was representing them. But
yeah.
Was he?
Yes.
Yeah, Joe Rao. I think he, was that the case in which he moved to have me held in contempt?
That's right.
Yeah. Griffin Bell sent me a hacksaw.
That's right.
Yeah.
You recounted that in your memoirs. Yeah. Tell me about the what you recall about the general condition of the. You mentioned there was a kind of a policy of neglect toward the OCR and the Nixon administration, Nixon and Ford administration, I guess.
Well, they just didn't enforce the civil rights laws. They didn't enforce the employment laws, and they didn't enforce the education laws. They weren't requiring school plans, and that's what brought all these cases to court.
Yeah. And so you were one thing that was on your mind when you became secretary was to revive the office and
revive the office. And I also did, and I did it in the Office for Civil Rights case, as distinguished from this case. I don't know which case. I went to court in one of the cases, or got justice to go to court on my behalf, and asked that we be relieved of the court order and let us run. That we would enforce the law, that it was a new administration, and the judge wouldn't let go.
I see. So technically, the office was actually under the court's control, or the court's direction.
In fact, if you go back, now I can't. It was the other case. I wanted to change the whole system by which the Office of Civil Rights considered cases. Now, most of these are individual cases. This is not the school case. And in that situation, and I was inhibited in making them much more efficient by the court order. So
I see.
I took a few shots at the judge at some bar association meeting somewhere along the way, and he got very pissed off.
How did you perceive the office as operating? I know in your Governing America. You mentioned that your predecessor as secretary had warned you that the OCR was, or could have been, had the potential to be semi-autonomous, independent.
I didn't. I mean, I tried as best I could to bring that whole department under control. I put a very good guy in there, David Tatel.
Yeah. And were you confident that...
The first general counsel I named was Peter Labasi, who had run the office in the Johnson administration at the end. So I thought I had the ability to control it. I think we brought it under greater control,
And the lower-level bureaucracy, mid-level bureaucracy was...
Well, I mean, it's a combination of leading them and controlling them.
Yeah.
I wish I was as good as they think I was now.
tell me about your sense of being in sync with David Tatel. Did you always feel as though whatever he did was something that you were happy with?
No, I mean, like anybody else, I mean, we agreed and disagreed. I mean, I had a lot of very bright, I believe, very bright, talented, and aggressive people working for me. And by no means, with respect to any of them, did we always agree.
Yeah. And that's something you wanted, I guess, was disagreement. You
well,
want
I wanted guys to tell me what they thought.
Yeah, yeah. What about the White House? But tell me about the obviously the White House is under considerable pressure on this case and on the tobacco case.
I think I recounted everything.
Everything you recall in the book.
Yeah. Everything I recall about the White House in the book.
Yeah.
And you can rely on that. I mean, I checked with everything I wrote in that, every quote in that book, I checked with the people that said them.
Oh, did you? Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, you have a very specific account there. Was that based on memory totally, or?
On which now?
In the book.
On the OCR thing?
Yes.
No, I checked with people.
You checked with people directly?
That was not. I had a young man working for me, I guess, for about 18 months.
I see.
On that, and we called people. I'm very proud of that. I mean, I in that whole book, the only complaint I got was from a guy named Bob Myers, who's a Social Security actuary guru, who questioned two of the numbers in the Social Security chapter.
Uh-huh.
But aside from, and I don't think he was right, or they were certainly debatable, but aside from that, nobody questioned me on any fact in that book.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they will when you interview them, I don't know.
Yeah. Tell me about the breakdown of the negotiations in 1979. I don't want you to repeat what you said in the book, but I'd like for you to elaborate. One of the things
I just don't remember.
Don't remember, yeah.
I'm sorry. Have you talked to Dick Beattie?
No, I haven't. I wrote him a letter today, as a matter of fact.
Okay, you should talk to him. You talk to Tatel. You might also talk to Hale Champion. He wasn't deeply involved in it, but he was involved.
Uh-huh.
He's up at Harvard, the Kennedy School of Government.
Is there anyone else who... comes to mind that
those are the ones I remember.
Those are the key ones. Yeah. Let me ask you just one final question about this case. In retrospect, do you think there's anything you would have done differently in terms of prosecuting the case, or in terms of? This might be an unfair question, but.
Well. I just don't. I mean, I have to go back into it. I mean, were there things we could have done better? Or sure, I'm sure there were things. But I think under the circumstances, we did it about as well as we could.
Mm-hmm.
In my own mind, I always had misgivings about having a federal district judge sitting in Washington desegregating school districts in 11 states or whatever it was around the country. And the ability to do that intelligently and fairly. Two, I never understood the kind of wholesale resistance. I mean, you know, I sent Tatel down. And we had, you know, I sent Tatel and somebody else down there to go visit these black schools because I thought if we could get North Carolina citizens to see the dramatic difference in quality, I mean, they were both separate and unequal, that we might be able to get a little support from them.
Mm-hmm.
And thirdly, this is not a misgiving, but I would not underestimate the added difficulty brought about by two things. One, the large number of blacks and black colleges involved, which clearly increased the resistance of Bill Friday and his board and the white establishment down there. And secondly, the anger of North Carolina, financial community and tobacco community over the anti-smoking campaign, which made it very difficult for politicians like Jim Hunt, who's basically a responsible person and I basically, he is a responsible person and a good governor. And I think Friday was a very good university chancellor. Uh-huh. But it made it very difficult, if not impossible, for Hunt to seem to be dealing with me. You know, whereas I think in Virginia I was dealing with Miles Godwin, who was, you know, had been a very, much more conservative than Friday or Hunt, much more opposed to desegregating. But in two or three phone conversations, we had a deal. And that, but he didn't have any, you know, I wasn't carrying any baggage in Virginia, any added baggage.
The black colleges, of course, had a certain set of vested interests
well,
here.
Well, absolutely, yeah. And that created its own set of problems. Sure, yeah. I didn't mention that. But that was true everywhere. Now, maybe the numbers in North Carolina made that a little more difficult. That was true everywhere. They had their own bureaucracy. They wanted to run their own universities. They were all scared they'd get swallowed.
Right. Did you have much, I mean, what was exactly the role of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund?
I just couldn't tell you.
It wasn't anything that you...
Nothing that reached me.
That reached you, yeah.
Sure. Have you talked to Tatel?
Well, we're going to talk eventually. Okay. So I'm looking forward to talking to him. Let me go back to the task force, the White House task force.
Mm-hmm.
The task force didn't get anywhere, I gather. I mean, the report that was written wasn't adopted. In fact, didn't it get sort of buried? Is that accurate to say?
Well, I have to go look at it. I mean, you know, we had a lot of task forces.
Okay.
It depends what you mean by adopted. it had one important effect, which was we had ammunition to keep the government focused on putting its education money into the hands of poor people. That was important.
Mm-hmm.
When you get down to specific recommendations, I think you find with respect to all of those task forces, and there were scores and scores of them in the Johnson years, that we accomplished most of what seemed to make sense to us.
Mm-hmm. I see. Any final sort of reflections on Bill Friday that you'd like to, I mean, general
no,
sort of things?
No, I mean, I think he's, you know, I think it's, you know, is he still alive?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You interviewed him?
Yes, at some length, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think he always struck me as a first-class guy, and I think he was just, you know, caught in something.
Yeah. And was caught between forces at inside North Carolina that affected his...
black colleges.
Yeah.
Difficult board.
Yeah.
Difficult political situation.
Sure.
And at that stage in his life, among the things he was willing to stick his head up for, this was not one of them.
Yeah. And your dealings with the board, you found the board to be, or your impression of the board, at least, was that it was pulling him.
Yeah, you have to. Tatel and Beatty will both be very good on that.
They'd have more detail than
a lot.
Yeah. Well, this has been very helpful, and I certainly appreciate you taking the time. I know you're...
Okay, and as I said, I'd add Hale Champion to your list of people.
Okay, and he's at Harvard.
Yeah, Harvard School of Government, Kennedy School of Government.
Yeah. Do you think Labasi is...
He's... I'd add Labasi, yeah. I'm sure he was involved in that.
Yeah. Okay, well...
All righty.
Thank you again.
Okay, good luck, and I look forward to seeing your book.
Okay, I'll send it to you.
All right, thank you.
Thanks a lot.